Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday, March 12th. 34 degrees here in Old Town Park City, as well as in the Heber Valley, with some clouds definitely in the forecast. On the phone with us, with the ABC Forecast Center meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at plenty of sunshine, a couple of high clouds from time to time, and breezy winds coming in this afternoon. Temperatures are warm into the mid-50s for us in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 60s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Friday, the warm-up will stick around across the area with those highs in the mid to upper 50s in Park City with plenty of sunshine. We'll see those highs in the mid-60s in the Heber Valley with, again, mostly sunny to partly sunny skies expected across the area. Moving into the weekend, there is going to be a weak cool front that's going to move our way as we get into your Saturday, and that's going to lead to a few more clouds out there. So we'll call it partly to mostly cloudy skies across the Wasatch Back. Now, as we go into the afternoon, high temperatures will be in the low 50s in Park City. We'll see those highs still around 60 degrees in the Heber Valley. We will introduce a chance of a few isolated showers and maybe even a rumble of thunder or two as we go into your Saturday night. There is a decent chance of that, so keep that in mind. Should not be a complete washout or an all-night rain or anything, but as that front moves through, could have a couple of isolated rumbles of thunder. Temperatures by the time you wake up on your Sunday will definitely be colder. We'll be back down with morning low temperatures in the mid to upper 20s for us on Sunday morning, and it will be cooler in the daytime with highs only around 40 degrees in Park City and highs only in the upper 40s to near 50 in the Heber Valley. Moving into next week, we'll start off with a few more clouds out there, but otherwise a mixture of clouds and sunshine. Temperatures will be warming into the low to mid 50s in Park City. We'll see those highs back around 60 degrees in the Heber Valley, and then a massive ridge of high pressure builds in as we get towards the second half of the week and will likely stick around at least through next weekend. So that means we're going to be looking at some potential all-time warm temperatures building into the region as we go into the end of next week and into next weekend. So that means high temperatures by the time we get towards next Wednesday will be approaching 70 degrees for us in the Park City area, with highs approaching 80 degrees in the Heber Valley by the middle of next week. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And now with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, it's Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Morning, Leslie. The danger is generally low in the backcountry. Normal caution is advised. As always, risk is inherent in mountain travel. If you are heading out into the backcountry today, you may see some minor wet, loose avalanches in the steep solar terrain. We do feel that the persistent weak layer from January is mostly dormant. And it means that it's unlikely but not impossible to trigger one of these hard slabs 2 to 4 feet deep. But we feel like it's mostly dormant, but will probably resurface during next week's scalding temperatures. So we're going to be expecting wet slab avalanches for next week. Glide avalanches continue to occur in the standard terrain of Stairs, Broads, Milby South, Upper Porter Fork. But again, overall, low danger. Keep an eye on the strong winds along the highest elevations. Most of these hard slabs are inert and dormant, but again, not impossible. But we have a 5-point danger scale, and the danger is generally low. So as always, you can get more information. Please read the fine print in today's forecast. That's about all the news from the Avalanche Center this morning.
Okay, Drew, thanks.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council member Candace Hart. Later on, Park City Board of Realtors President Gretchen Hudgens, the president of the Park City MLS Grady Kohler, and CEO Jennifer Armandi have details on the year-end report for 2025. And finally, Park City Film Executive Director Katie Wang with a preview of some of their upcoming screenings. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include archaeologist Lisbeth Lauterbach, curator at the Natural History Museum of Utah and associate professor at the University of Utah, about her new research suggesting indigenous people in the Four Corners region may have begun domesticating the potato thousands of years earlier than previously believed. Then robotics, high school style, Park City High School's all-girl robotic team, Team Minerva, fresh off their playoff appearance and heading to the state championships. All of that coming up today, 9 o'clock on Cool Science Radio. Taking a look now at some local news, Corey Richens' housekeeper testified she bought Richens the fentanyl prosecutors say she allegedly used to kill her husband, Eric. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports prosecutors are now facing accusations that the housekeeper lied on the stand.
During cross-examination 2 weeks ago, Corey Richens' attorneys tried to show that Carmen Lauber was fabricating testimony. She was Corey Richens' housekeeper, who defense attorney Wendy Lewis calls the Summit County prosecutor's star witness. The defense team says Lauber is saying what investigators want her to say because of a deal that gives her immunity in exchange for her cooperation. Summit County Detective Jeff O'Driscoll says that's not a fair picture.
It was apparent to me that she probably had some level of guilt or concern over her possible involvement in Eric's death.
Lauber says she bought fentanyl at Corey Richens' request before Eric Richens' fentanyl overdose death in 2022. Corey Richens has pleaded not guilty to charges of aggravated murder, attempted murder, and other financial crimes. During the investigation, a private investigator provided Eric and Corey Richens' phone records, and O'Driscoll says his team compared those to the data on the phones themselves. There appeared to be numerous missing messages between Corey Richens and Lauber, which eventually led investigators to search Lauber's house in April of 2023. O'Driscoll, who took over as lead investigator on the case, says they found a hat from Eric Richens' business and his obituary in her bedroom.
It seems like she had all of these inspirational quotes that helped motivate her through her progression in drug court, and amongst them were photos of her loved ones, her family, and then amongst all of that was Eric Richens' obituary.
Dead center, wasn't it?
Yep, right in the middle of the mirror.
Then O'Driscoll says he and his partner, Detective Eric Maynard, interviewed Lauber 6 times over the next month. When Lauber testified at trial, defense attorneys used parts of those interviews to discredit her. The detectives told her at times she had a get-out-of-jail-free card or that she needed to divulge the details that ensure Corey Richens gets convicted of murder. Judge Richard Mrazek allowed Chief Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth to play longer excerpts of those interviews Wednesday to put those parts in context.
Certainly there was a self-serving piece, but there was a lot more than a self-serving piece.
But prosecutors also had another issue as it relates to Lauber. The defense says it was not made aware that she'd violated conditions of drug court in November 2023. They motioned for a mistrial March 4th because they hadn't been able to cross-examine Lauber based on that information. Mrazek has denied the defense's request, but he did instruct prosecutors to recall Lauber to testify Wednesday for additional questioning. The cross-examination problem is one of numerous issues Corey Richens' attorneys have been raising that could become central to the case if appealed. The defense is also continuing to object to much of prosecutors' evidence, even if Mrazek had already ruled it was admissible before trial. Bloodworth says O'Driscoll is the state's last witness. Defense attorney Kathy Nestor says she needs to confer with Corey Richens to make some decisions before the defense presents a case. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Summit County Council yesterday delayed a vote on the Utah Olympic Parks Development Agreement amendments, and another two-hour work session will happen next week. On the phone with a recap of yesterday's meeting is Summit County Council Chair Canis Hart. Good morning, Canis.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you doing?
Doing well, thank you. So the council spent about an hour and a half yesterday discussing those proposed changes. Now you've scheduled another two hours for the project next week. Are you surprised the item didn't make it to a vote last night?
I'm not surprised given it only had an hour on the agenda. I personally think it should have had 2 or maybe 3 hours on the agenda yesterday. And then I think we may have gotten to a vote. What we decided in the end was, you know, we need to have some really, very strong or considered considerations. I'm not sure if you can say considered considerations, but we need to have time to really craft that language. I mean, ultimately the council may vote for or against it. That's still yet to be determined, but you have to know what you're voting on, and I don't think we could cobble those conditions together like in 5 or 10 minutes. So we asked to have a couple hours next week, which that meeting will be back in the Richens building, so people close to this topic can get to the meeting. And then we'll see what we can come up with then. So I just think it was time. Like, we just needed more time.
All right. Well, last night's conversation comes after the council received a letter from the Sun Peak Homeowners Association board that raised several concerns about the plans, including things like short-term rentals, use of the emergency access gate. I guess, which of those concerns, if any, do you share?
Well, I would suppose we share all of them. Like, we're always concerned about short-term rentals and what the effect is. That was brought up in last night's conversation. It sounds like for people familiar with the area, you know, there's a athlete building that's down near the sort of landing area, the ski jumps. And that building, and then they want to build basically a second one like it, those would be where they would focus short-term rentals. So I haven't seen, you know, we haven't crafted what these conditions would be, but I'm sure I'd be very surprised if we didn't have conditions around nightly rentals. The road access, though it's a, you know, a public road or a county road, and technically, you know, anybody can drive on it, I think we're very concerned, you know, for the neighbors about traffic and congestion that might go through their neighborhood. So that is certainly there. There's quite a few things. You know, I think you probably heard, or if anyone's listening, another concern that we have is just about growth. And, you know, what are they looking to do? Is it an expanded allowed use? We love the UOP. We'd love to support the UOP, but we also don't want to give it just a free pass. So we want to make sure we, you know, do the work the right way. So I guess, Leslie, the answer is we kind of share everyone's concerns, and we probably have some more of our own as well.
Yeah. The Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation says it's gone out of its way to create a way for the Homeowners Association to partner with the foundation on a gate access policy. So how much do you think that change will help ease neighbors' concerns?
Well, I don't think they – I'm almost like a spectator in this, because you can see the – homeowners like in the audience, and then you have the UOP personnel at the table speaking. And when I'm just looking at nods of heads, you know, like yes and no, it doesn't look like there's agreement on what they've where they've partnered or not. So I don't know that I have a good read on how much is actually mutually agreed upon at this point.
Okay. The foundation operates at a deficit, according to CEO Colin Hilton, at about $3 to $4 million every year. He walked the council through this new proposed revenue stream that could help make that deficit smaller, like this tax increment financing plan. Councilmember Chris Robinson said, however, that TIF may not give enough juice for the squeeze, as he put it, meaning it's just a temporary source of revenue for the foundation. So do you share his worries about the TIF being the main way for the foundation to boost its revenue?
Yes, absolutely. I think probably the entire council does. I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but it's a sentiment I've heard from other council members. You know, we're selective, and we had Chris go first in comments because we thought he'd be able to break down these topics that, you know, we've all talked about. For anyone listening, you know, if you the big thing here is the UOP wants to put a hotel in there, and they want to create revenue from that hotel. And the way that they would primarily get, I mean, not exclusively, but primarily get financing is from a tax increment, or basically by self-taxing and then keeping the tax revenue within the UOP, opposed to, say, just profits from a hotel. And so what Chris raised, and I think this is what we all share, is like, well, that's fine, but it seems like for all the work and for all the build, for that to be the only way you get financing, it doesn't seem to be, as fruitful as maybe one would hope. And I think Chris Conaby, who is a developer for UOP, you know, his response was something to the effect of, you know, we cannot think of another way. This is the best way we can think of to get it done.
Bond wouldn't work?
I would imagine a bond would work, but they would run out. I think what they're trying to do is create something that's sustaining, which is also kind of part of what Chris and the council was raising as well. How sustaining is the tax increment financing if it could run out? So they also, and at the same time, they want to create this zone. I forget what it's called, the major sports venue. You might know it, Leslie.
That's right.
But yeah, and so by doing that, you can create this taxing entity, and then that's where they're saying they would get financing in perpetuity, would be off of that zone. So that was also raised by the council. It was like, well, the order, so you know, you're asking us to approve this hotel and this deal, but you don't have the tax increment financing approved yet. That would have to come before the county council. And this major sports venue would also have to be done in conjunction with the council. So the whole thing kind of assumes those two things would happen. And like I said, we're friendly to the UOP and the Legacy Foundation and would love to see them be successful. We're just really trying to wade through this carefully.
Now, the council gave the canyon's developer, TCFC, a public infrastructure district. You did add a condition about building a transit center for bus rapid transit. But can you break down what the community would be getting out of this deal?
Yeah, personally, I don't know that I see it as the community gets a lot out of this deal. That was one of where I was resistant or voted no initially when it came before us, is because I didn't see any real benefit. It was just going to potentially expedite growth. But where this has gone in this conversation, so this would allow the canyons to self-tax themselves and keep the funding, and that just helps them get bonds to finance their development up in the canyons. The one area that I think, there's two areas that I think are public benefits, though probably not the most exciting to everybody, but they're now going to contribute up to $1 million for the bus rapid transit station. That would be over by the 7-Eleven at the Cabriolet. So I see that as an advantage, that, you know, that financing would come from them and from that taxing district, opposed to High Valley Transit having to pay for that. And then the other one is, and like I said, not the most exciting thing, but there's a road that everybody needs access to that's actually a private road. And in this agreement, this, whether it's given to the county or the county just gets a license to use it, that would be resolved as well. So those are really kind of the two benefits I think the community gets.
All right. Council member Tanya Hansen said she wants to see nightly rentals restricted outside of the hotel. And I guess, why are additional short-term rentals needed? And who are these for?
You know, what's funny is I don't remember her talking about that in the PID. You know what I remember her talking about mostly in the PID was the convention center. But I apologize. I must have missed that conversation about the nightly rentals. But I would say, I mean, it kind of goes back to like the big picture thing. We're all trying to figure out how to manage nightly rentals. And bigger picture, we're kind of thinking of these zones. And why I'm a little confused by what her comment would have been is the canyons is one of these areas we think of as a zone for nightly rentals.
Okay, well, the foundation is proposing a hotel and in addition to have some of the units that they build as nightly rentals. And I'm guessing, why do you need both?
I'm sorry, you're back at the UOP. I'm sorry, I thought we were still just on the canyons pit. My bad. I do remember this part of the conversation. So that athlete housing, the one that I was talking about that's down near the ski jumps, they say that they use that for nightly rentals. So what they were articulating was that they need about 80 beds, because what happens is when families come in for events, coaches and others stay in these nightly rentals. Now, why they wouldn't just be in the hotel, I don't know. Maybe it's just overflow, but they didn't address that specifically.
All right. But again, that could be conditioned, no? Those nightly rentals?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I would say that, you know, the thing is, when it's a legislative decision, the council has great latitude on what we condition. And, you know, it's really our focus is putting conditions in that mitigate the impacts to those around it. And we have full latitude to do that, which is kind of goes back to the original point of, we didn't want to just try to cobble that together in like 5 or 10 minutes. We wanted to be able to really think through this and figure out what these conditions would be that would try to meet or manage the concerns of, you know, the residents around it.
All right. Another thing you discussed last night was the, quote, waterfall of how affordable housing will be prioritized. Are you happy with the current proposal of giving the UOP workforce first dibs, then athletes, then others?
I think generally I'm in favor of it. I haven't heard of an alternative that, you know, sounds better to me. I don't know that got as much attention probably as some of the other points we've been talking about. But I haven't heard anyone push back on that either.
All right. There was a member of the public who gave public comment last night, but her microphone didn't work for about the first half of her speech. Can you tell us what that comment was about? It sounded like she was rattling off a list.
Yeah, honestly, I had the document in front of me, so I was reading it, and I read it prior to the meeting because, you know, we were aware that they're going to come give public comment, and I honestly cannot make sense of what it means. I guess I would liken it to this, and maybe I'm wrong, so if she's listening or anyone's listening, I apologize. She had a couple people with her. If anybody's familiar with Sovereign Citizens, I kind of assumed it was something like that. It sounded like a lot of it applied to the state of Florida. And then it had something to do with like establishing authority under Marine Corps veterans, maritime something. After they left, we were all kind of just wondering what that was or what it was about. I know they filmed it, but it was something that they wanted to read, and it was within the policy of public comment to allow it. So, you know, we accommodated that.
Hmm. Maybe they're putting together a film or something.
Yeah, maybe. But Leslie, I should send you the document. Like, you read it, you can't make sense of it.
Okay. Let's see. The council still needs to come up with conditions for approval of these changes. I mean, can you give us an idea of what some of those conditions might look like?
Well, I think we're talking on UAP, right? So I think we're going to talk about is the things that we've been kind of hitting on. You know, there's a lot of concern around the road, so I imagine there's going to be conditions on gate access or the use of the Bear Hollow Road up there. You know, I think we're going to be looking at limitations around the development. These are sort of what I presume will happen based on the conversations. I think we're going to look at this financing mechanism and nightly rentals for sure. There's quite a few things to look at, but I think all the major points we've talked about will be addressed.
Okay. So we've got another work session at the Richens Building next week. When do you think you'll try to bring up a vote on the item?
What I do know, because afterwards this came up in conversation, is that the agenda will be stylized as 2 hours for a work session, and then I think it has a separate item immediately following saying a possible vote, so that it will be noticed that we can vote if we think we've got it figured out that same day. And then if we cannot, if we run out of time, I would presume then it would be the following week.
All right. Anything else from last night's meeting that you wanted to make sure we knew about?
No, it seemed like a lot of mechanical things. I think UAP was the one that probably was of the most public interest. But generally speaking, I think everything was pretty clear. But, you know, if anybody has any questions, please contact the county council or send me an email, and I'd be happy to respond to you.
Okay. You are set to approve new members of the Housing Authority Commission.
Yeah.
Did you just reapply the...
Yeah, it's pretty standard practice, you know, unless someone's done something crazy, you know, we generally reappoint. But I will say that the other two applicants, Dre Costello and Ben Castor, were both so impressive that we're actually looking behind the scenes to see if there's a way we could utilize them. So maybe another announcement next week, because it's like an embarrassment of riches, I tell you, the quality of the people we have in our community. So the three were reappointed, and then we're trying to figure out a way to utilize the others.
All right. Candace Hart, chairman of the Summit County Council, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a great day.
Well, the Park City real estate market finished 2025 with one of its strongest years on record, reaching $5.75 billion in total sales volume, the second highest in history behind the pandemic boom. And in the studio with details, I have the CEO of the Park City Board of Realtors, Jennifer Amandi, Board President Gretchen Hudgens, along with the President of the Multiple Listing Services, Grady Kohler. Good morning to everyone.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, so Jennifer, we haven't had a chance to have you in studio. We talked to you, of course, when you were appointed, but you've been on the job, what, 6-8 months?
Not as long as that, but yes, we're making great progress, as if I've been here that long. Probably about 4.5 months at this point. So it's been a wonderful transition, and I've been really enjoying getting to know the community here.
Okay, so what's keeping you busy?
Well, Gretchen and I and the rest of our board and executive team are doing a lot of work in regards to committees and revitalizing our volunteer leadership efforts within the organization. We're going to be looking at doing some additional governance work this year, which sounds really exciting, but is actually really the foundation of how we offer our services to our members. So there's a lot of behind the scenes that are happening this year, and we're really proud of the work that we've put in so far.
Okay. Let's see. Gretchen, how would you, you've been a realtor in town for a while, how would you summarize 2025?
You know, 2025 was a really interesting year. We saw overall the market really excel from our 2009 curve heading all the way up. Outside of that, you know, little nuance that we had in over the COVID years, what we're seeing is really strong markets, especially in our new developments, but our existing and remodeled homes are still selling really nicely.
Okay, and Grady, can you give us an idea how the 2025 market may have compared with 2024?
Yeah, it's up across the board, it is a tale of multiple markets. So you have to remember that new construction and existing home sales, if you pull those apart, you do see different things. And also every area has a micro climate in itself.
Right.
But if you do take the Park City MLS and you compare it against national averages, we're up about 6% sales transaction count year over year, whereas nationwide is pretty flat. So we are outpacing the U.S. market.
Mm-hmm. So that 6% is homes sold.
And number of homes sold.
Right, but what are we seeing with the prices of homes?
Prices also went up. So we jumped from an average price of 1.6 to almost 2 million as a median sales price. That's about a 19% increase.
Wow.
And if you compare that against the U.S. average, the U.S. went up about 1.6%.
Right. Now, are we seeing kind of hot spots within that?
For sure. Yeah, the hot spots are new construction. A lot of new markets that popped up for us, like Jordanelle.
Yeah. And anything that you saw kind of decrease in prices sold?
Yes, there were certain markets that struggled against other markets. Camas, in particular, that was flat or down in some markets.
Okay. So, Jennifer, I guess with 2025 ending with the second highest sales volume ever in Park City's history, what does that say about the strength of the local real estate market right
now? Well, when you're in a resort community, there's always going to be a strong desire to want to be here. The combination of this, the summer and winter activities are going to attract nationwide buyers. So I think that while we might see a bit of a leveling off, as Gretchen had mentioned, the post-pandemic years, we're not going to, it's never an always or a never, but I don't think we're going to see a decline in demand like we might see in other markets across the country. So we're still going to see a very active buyer desire to want to be here in Park City.
Mm-hmm. And as we, Grady noted, I mean, we saw those sales prices go up. So are those kind of increases, I mean, 19% sustainable?
That's a really great question. I would say that, well, it depends on who it's sustainable for, right? Our buyer pool is nationwide. So I think that for a certain segment of the demographic that's moving here, it is sustainable. But as you know, I think yesterday you had a local housing authority on Mountainlands, Jason Glidden, I think, was here. We're doing a lot of work locally with nonprofits to really help that affordability issue for those folks who can't really attain that, they're not going to be able to afford that 19% increase. We really have to address the mix of who is coming here, who wants to be a part of the lifestyle that we have here, but how do we also maintain homeownership values and homeownership opportunities for our local communities? So I think that there's work to do there, but based on the type of demographic or the type of culture that we have, it's going to sustain.
Mm-hmm. And Gretchen, even though some segments did see fewer sales, prices continue to rise. So what's driving that price growth, you think?
You know, I think a lot of it is, as Jen mentioned, that real desire to live in Park City, the community, the activities that we have. We're seeing a different demographic coming in, a younger buyer, a more active, ingrained in the community buyer, which is really changing what they're looking at and where they're wanting to buy and really keeping our market strong.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up because that's what agents apparently reporting, younger buyers kind of entering the market. Just the fun that we have here, the outdoor activity, is what's kind of driving them.
I think that is a big part of it. I also think our school systems, our community, the fact that we're a very philanthropic community. There's a lot in my mind that drives that. The ease of our location compared to a lot of other mountain communities. I'm from Colorado. I choose Park City, and I will choose Park City forever. In part because we have Salt Lake and an international airport. It makes our lifestyle attainable as far as living in the mountains, but still being able to do business.
Yeah. So where are they coming from? I mean, they're coming from outside the area, and then they've just got really great, maybe remote jobs or something?
Yes, you'd be surprised. We were seeing a lot of people from the Chicago area, Texas, Vegas is a big one, still Californians coming in, and we welcome them.
The report says that many sellers are older homeowners or investors. Is that creating more opportunities for these new buyers?
I think so. We're really seeing that shift as we've talked about macroeconomics with the boomers kind of the wealth transfer happening, and we're seeing that wealth transfer happen and our younger buyers being able to come in and maybe pick up some homes that maybe they wouldn't have because they need a little bit more attention, but that's giving them opportunity to step into the market and create their own home here.
Mm-hmm. Now, new construction, of course, playing a larger role, especially in areas like you mentioned, the Jordanelle and Heber Valley. So how does that change the overall supply housing in the region? Because for years we were dealing with just no inventory.
Absolutely, and inventory is up and up substantially. We see a 14% increase in our inventory, which if you look at nationwide statistics, that's just not true. But I think because of our market and our people's desire to be here, the growth and the desire for new construction is really fueling that, allowing more and more people to move in.
Yeah, so as buyers paying a premium for those new construction, move-in ready homes, are the older homes becoming harder to sell?
In part, it is definitely taking strategic pricing and a strategic buyer that has vision to see what that home can be. At the same time, some of those are the most desirable because they're in the best locations. They want to be right in Lower Deer Valley. They want to be in Upper Deer Valley, maybe Park Meadows, and they're willing to pay a premium even though it might need some attention.
Yeah, I mean, you probably don't see a lot of that, but the construction industry would. But I mean, are we talking about just full-on remodels, or are we talking going to the bones of the house?
I would say both.
Yeah. Amenities like golf memberships and ski access also appear to be driving the significant price differences. How important are those in today's market?
Really important. Having some sort of access to something beyond just the mountain trails that we all have access to has become really important for our buyers. They're looking for a true lifestyle. As they look to move to Park City, it's not necessarily about a job. It's not necessarily just the location. It's what they're getting from this location. And so for them, it's really important that they are being able to utilize what's around them, including our golf courses, our lakes, and our trails.
Yeah. The report also mentions concerns about snow conditions, rising insurance costs, and rental market pressures. I guess which of those factors could have the biggest impact on this year's market?
I think the biggest impact for us this year will be our snow. That obviously has caused concerns. I think our mountains have done a really great job in utilizing the snow that they have, but our warmer temperatures mean it doesn't matter how much snow capacity they can make. If the temperatures are warm, we're going to struggle. As we think about what that means, not just for the winter months, but moving into the summer months, that impacts our fire mitigation, our fire hazards, and we're already seeing and struggling with losing insurance over fire. It's something that we as a board have worked on both in the state and national level of how we can protect our homeowners and ensure that they can still get fire insurance, just like it's been nationally mandated on the flood level. We want to see that on the fire side as well.
Yeah. Now, with more affordable housing being built and certainly more to come, is that having an impact on the investment properties that people have used for maybe long-term rentals?
I think there's such a need for affordable housing, both rental and purchase, that it has not impacted people's ability to use like an ADU or a basement apartment to still get long-term housing. With our growth, we're also seeing a growth in need for employment, and that is bodies. And so the more that we see our growth, the more that will impact our long-term rents and purchases. And so if people have that and it's available for them to rent, I think it's very important that we're doing that.
All right. And what impact, if any, will the Sundance Film Festival leaving Park City have on the local real estate market, or perhaps the short-term rental market?
I'm so proud of our community and the way that we handle things like that. It's been really fun to see people step up and say, okay, we've lost Sundance, but we're going to do other things and bring in other events and really relook at how we can shape our town and how we want that to move forward. And so overall, we're not seeing that be a big panic or a big cause for concern for future home buyers or investment buyers.
All right. I guess, Grady, I mean, if you had a crystal ball, I mean, what would you predict about the 2026?
Well, we've seen the early part of 2026 also still be strong. January and February are looking strong. That said, we are kind of coming into a balanced market. We have about 6 months of inventory. That means if no new product comes on the market, it would take about 6 months to sell everything that we have on the market. We know that new product is going to come on the market. But with 6 months of inventory, that's a pretty balanced market. So I'm looking forward to some growth, probably not as strong as we saw in 2025 because we're not going to see as much new product sell, but it's going to be a good year.
And I guess, Gretchen, what should people expect if they're thinking about buying or selling property this year?
I think if you're thinking about buying property, you're really thinking about where that is. Our market is incredibly segmented. As I like to say, there are no bad neighborhoods. It just depends on the lifestyle that you want. And so that will really dictate what you're thinking about as you're buying. The same is also true as you are considering selling. If your home is not new construction, we're definitely being more strategic on our pricing and how we are messaging the product out to our buyers and what that looks like for them. I think, you know, it's all about location and price, and that's a little bit more sensitive than we've seen it in the past years.
Yeah, and I'm guessing from a year ago, we're seeing a little bit easier opportunities because of the lowering of the interest rates, Jennifer?
Early indicators have shown that there has been an increase in mortgage applications, which is a very, you know, it's a great sign. Comparatively to our market, we have a much higher amount of cash buyers than we see nationally. So it depends on how you're looking at those numbers. So nationally, yes, mortgage applications have increased, which is a very positive sign in the market. That's maybe not necessarily touching us as much here as it is in other markets, but we're still, any sort of signs of improvement, we're excited to see.
All right. Any other thoughts from any of you?
No, I would just say that, you know, we're doing a lot of work. We really appreciate the time that you gave us today. I'm really proud of the realtors in our community. They're very involved. And my last plug would be, just as you can tell, it's a very complicated market that we have here. And so using a professional, local, knowledgeable realtor is always in your best interest.
All right. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We've got Park City Board of Realtors CEO Jennifer Amandi, President Gretchen Hutchins, and the President of the Park City MLS, Grady Kohler. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, on the phone now with an update from Park City Film, I have Executive Director Katie Wang. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so it's Oscar time. Tell us what you have on top for this weekend.
Yes, absolutely. It's my favorite time of year. It's kind of like Christmas and Hanukkah and your birthday, like all together. And we get to celebrate the year in film, which who doesn't love that? And for me, one of the special treats is that we also get to showcase the Oscar-nominated short films, which really are hard to see outside of the film festival environment. I mean, certainly with Sundance, we've been able to see some of them, but there's so many festivals out there and so many great short films. So we love to showcase them every year as we lead into the biggest award ceremony of the year. And so each night we're showing a different collection of films. On Friday night, we'll have the animated short films. Saturday night, we'll have the documentary short films. And then Sunday night, we'll have the live action or the narrative short films. And they're always incredibly creative and topical just because it takes, you know, less time to make a short than a feature length film. This year's collection even has a couple comedies, which is kind of rare, which are quite clever. So really looking forward to having everyone help us with that. Normal show times, Friday and Saturday at 7, Sunday at 6. Saturday, we're kind of doubling down on the shorts genre. Again, one of my favorite formats. So here we go. We are having a free matinee screening of Mountain Film on Tours, Tales of the World, or Relatos del Mundo. And these are short films in Spanish or with Spanish subtitles that celebrate adventure and the indomitable human spirit. Great for our community here. This is part of our Cine en Español series that we do with the Park City Library. Showtime for that matinee is 4 o'clock and admission is free. And then, of course, we're also hosting our annual Oscar party. We're quite busy this weekend on Saturday evening. Tickets are sold out to that event, but we still have tickets available for the Doc Shorts at 7. So do not be dissuaded. You can still engage with the films that evening. And just want to give a shout out to our sponsors who help bring together the Oscar party, Trent Hickman Real Estate, who's underwriting the shorts this weekend. We really couldn't do it all without the support we received from our community. So big thanks to them for that. And then, you know, the program goes on. We've still got some nominees and great films for the rest of the year coming up in our program. For the rest of this month, we have The President's Cake, which is set in 1990s Iraq, where a young girl is selected to bake a cake for Saddam Hussein as part of a mandatory celebration of his birthday at a time when food shortage
shortages and poverty ravaged the country. We'll have a post-film discussion with local executive producers Donna and Kevin Grunick after the film on Saturday evening. Then we have Andre's an Idiot, which was the winner of the 2025 Sundance Film Festival Audience Award, which is an unexpectedly irreverent and funny and life-affirming film about death and living your life with humor to the very end. It is a lot to unpack. It is exceptional. Then we have A Poet, which is a dark comedy from Columbia about a failed poet who's offered a chance at redemption by mentoring a young student but can't seem to get out of his own way. And then finally, a very special screening called The M Factor, Shredding the Silence on Menopause. We're partnering with the Community Foundation's Women's Giving Fund to show this powerful documentary that's really kind of a one of its kind that aims to remove the stigma surrounding menopause and aging and open up a conversation about women's health and how women can prepare themselves and find support during this radical change that all women face during middle age. We'll have small group discussions after the film, and that's on Thursday, March 26th at 7 p.m., and admission to that is free.
Okay. You know, last we talked, you were kind of still working out the plans for this summer, so anything to report on that way?
Yes. Yep. We've got two genre-based film series, so we'll be doing our normal kind of weekend program. We're taking a couple breaks for 4th of July, and there are a couple other events, Song Summit and such, that are coming through on the weekends, so kind of planning around those. But two kind of new things for us will be a genre film series. One is called America the Beautiful. That'll be at the end of June as we head into the celebration of the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. We wanted to showcase the diversity of the communities and peoples that populate the United States, certainly some of the stories that are not represented as well in the general history telling of our country. And then we'll have a Midnight in Park City series at the end of July into early August. And for those of you that have been to the Midnight series at Sundance Film Festival or others know what that genre is, but it's kind of sci-fi, horror, more adult-themed films. It's a great collection. It's not normally films that we would bring into our regular weekend series, so it's kind of fun to play around a little bit with that. And then in October, we're looking at doing kind of a mini little film series, film festival, that we're just working on the plans on now, but we're really excited to be able to showcase some of the best films of the season that haven't quite hit distribution yet, so kind of a best of festivals concept there, but that'll be in late October, and so we're still working on plans for that, but it's really exciting just to see, just as the realtors before me were saying, it's just the community rallying around, you know, the departure of Sundance and what do we do to fill the gap, the cultural gap in my case, and people are just excited to have kind of reimagine how film is presented in our community, how we engage with film. We're certainly not going to replace the Sundance Film Festival, but we can do a lot to engage our community through film and to highlight some of these amazing stories that are being told in the cinematic format. So we're really excited. I kind of think of it as like little Karens along the way when you're hiking, right? It's like little fires that light you throughout the year that get you excited and gather people together. So it's been fun to pull these ideas together and just see how people in the community are coming out to support it and be a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, are you anticipating screenings each weekend like you do during, you know, the rest of the year?
For the summertime?
Yeah.
I mean, it won't be every weekend, as I said, because there are some major events that happen. I mean, summer is so busy in Park City. We'll still have our outdoor screenings in Eastern Summit County. So we're just kind of, with these kind of genre film festivals, again, bringing people together in a more concentrated way. So instead of having three film screenings on a weekend, it would be more like 4 to 6. But again, different films, which is different for us, as opposed to just doing one film over the weekend. So we're playing around with the program and you know, certainly being intentional about and cognizant of what's going on around us. So we're not going to program over, like, you know, the Kimball Arts Festival, as an example, right? I mean, we're not going to program over 4th of July. So again, it's not just film for the sake of showing films. It's really, what are the opportunities where we can bring people together in an intentional way? What are the films that are out in the summertime? They typically tend to be more what we call, in the film world, kind of popcorn entertainment. Not a lot of indie films are released in the summertime, but there are some, and there are certainly some that are, as Park City Film does well, certainly this time of year, films that don't have a lot of visibility because they are smaller, they are independent films, but they're amazing, right? That doesn't mean that they're not great films, they just don't have a huge distributor behind them. So it gives us the opportunity to really kind of do what we do best and really lean into that idea that, you know, Robert Redford had so many years ago, decades ago, about showcasing independent stories and getting them in front of audiences and really, you know, making sure that those stories are getting out there into the world and being told and not just kind of ending up in the ether or online somewhere in obscurity.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, just, you know, please come out for the Oscar shorts this weekend. They are amazing. I love the short film format, as I've said many times. It's kind of the poetry of filmmaking. And do want to thank our sponsors for the Oscar party and just, you know, our membership in general. I feel like we've had so much support from the community. It's just been amazing to see. And we honestly could not imagine all of these new things if we didn't have that support behind us. So parkcityfilm.org for all of our films coming up. And we look forward to seeing everyone at the movies.
Okay. Katie, thanks.
Thank you.
Katie Wang is the executive director of Park City Film. Well, Park City has selected a new city manager. KPCW's Christine Weller reports that Adam Lenhart may be best known for his controversial approval of a town square drag show while he was working for the city of St. George.
Park City Mayor Ryan Dickey has selected Adam Lenhart as the town's next city manager with council support. The announcement follows a nationwide recruitment process which drew more than 70 applicants in all. Lenhart has a bachelor's degree in land use planning and resource management and a master of public administration from Brigham Young University. In 2011, he became the youngest city manager statewide when he was promoted to the role in Clearfield City. Lenhart joined St. George as city manager in 2018. There, he oversaw more than 1,200 employees and led a range of operational, budgeting, and organizational initiatives. Lenhart resigned from St. George in 2022 after what the Sully Tribune reported was pressure from the city council over his handling of a permit for a drag show on city property. The family-friendly show was part of the HBO program We're Here, which follows three former RuPaul's Drag Race contestants who travel to conservative towns. Each episode ends with a public drag show featuring local residents. Some council members were unhappy with the decision, but in an email obtained by the Tribune, Lenhart told the council he believed the program had a First Amendment right to use the town square and that a denial would be discriminatory. Lenhart told KPCW St. George has been home for the last 8 years and he loved his team with the city. He wouldn't change his decision regarding the permit.
As a city manager, I take an oath like other city officials and elected officials to support, obey, and defend the Constitution of the United States. We looked at the issue very carefully. It was an administrative issue. It was ultimately the city manager's call. I made my decision. I stand by it.
Since leaving government, Lenhart has worked as a director in the private sector construction industry since 2023. He said he wanted to return to city management as he has a passion for it.
It gives a really unique opportunity to be in a position where you can make a difference. And my goal has always been to make a positive difference in the communities that I live in, that I work for.
In a statement, Dickey said Lenhart brings a strong track record of organizational leadership. He said, quote, throughout this process, Lenhart demonstrated a thoughtful approach and a clear understanding of the opportunities and challenges facing our community. Dickey said he appreciates the council's support throughout the recruitment and looks forward to working together as they take the next step forward for Park City. Lenhart said he's honored to have Dickey's trust and is grateful for the council's support. He said he's also in a unique position as he's seen firsthand some of the challenges Park City faces, including affordable housing.
Very early in my career, my wife and I and our two oldest kids had the chance to live in Park City for just a short time, and we loved it. It was about 9 months. I'd like to think we would have stayed, but winter rolled around and the little apartment we were in Prospector got converted to a nightly rental.
Lenhart said he looks forward to serving Park City and working with the mayor, city council, staff, and community members. The Park City Council is set to confirm Lenhart as city manager at its regular meeting March 19th. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And a winter that rarely got cold left Nordic skiers across the Wasatch back with scant options. KPCW's Grace Darfler reports Soldier Hollow and White Pine Nordic Center trying to make the best of Utah's dismal snow season.
On a sunny afternoon in early March, a handful of skiers skated along ribbons of snow that crisscrossed an otherwise grassy hillside. The temperature was approaching 50 degrees at Soldier Hollow Nordic Center near Midway, and Bill Pierce was fighting to keep the terrain open.
It's been the most, trying winter I've ever seen. It is by far the warmest I've ever experienced. Mm-hmm. I do believe this is our future.
Pierce is the venue operations director at Soldier Hollow, and this year, snowbaking has been imperative.
We had one snowfall this year here. We literally manufactured winter.
Even with the help from snow guns, Pierce says Soldier Hollow only opened about 20% of its terrain. Many days, record warm temperatures also prevented the venue from making snow. Further north, Richard Hodges, who runs the Nordic Center at White Pine Touring in Park City, says this year has been unprecedented. The season had just 38 days of skiing, compared to 130 in a normal winter. White Pine's farm loop, near McPolin Barn along State Route 224, never opened at all. He says White Pine is considering what it would take to introduce snowmaking, at least on some of its trails.
Certainly having kind of a limited snowmaking loop on the golf course would be a huge, huge public amenity here. You know, how long will there be snow in the Park City proper in the future? There are enough cold days in Park City that you could make a fair amount of snow, but it, you know, it's a partnership and cooperation kind of project that has would have to come together.
Down the mountain in Wasatch County, Pierce says Soldier Hollow is looking for new ways to innovate too. A pile of snow over 40 feet tall sits on the hillside above the lodge, where it will be stored under insulated white tarps until November.
Right away, we have an instant base, and when we turn guns on, we are making snow on snow right away. And so that's what's happening in order to prolong winter and open earlier.
While the Wasatch Backs Nordic Centers look for ways to create or prolong winter, skiers say they will take what they can get. Salt Lake City resident Marshall Opal made the trip to Soldier Hollow several times per week this year to help coach the Nordic Betties, a local cross-country ski group.
We're seeing this winter what a gift it is. And I think this winter, maybe if it could show us some reverence for having skiing at all, that just to be able to go out and slide around on frozen water is magical. And anytime you're out on skis, you're just a very lucky human.
Soldier Hollow is hosting the NCAA Championships March 11th through the 14th, and White Pine Touring is closed for the season. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.